720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today, sharing part of your very snowy and chilly, blustery Saturday with us today. Appreciate you for joining and taking time out of your weekend to tune in. So lots to do on the show today. We're going to be talking a little bit about a very surprising and unexpected partnership with Coca-Cola and the Chinese government. And a little bit after that, we're going to talk about Elwood, Illinois, a crucial shipping stop for some of the big, big shipping companies. We're going to take a look at that and plenty more. But right now we're joined by Robert Chanik, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, and of course, regular contributor to this program, who wrote about the legacy of Sears in Chicago and ways that that brand will live on even if the stores vanish from our local landscape. Hi, thanks for being with us today, Chanik.
How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us. So talk to us about Sears, because I feel like you and I have talked many times about Sears and how they're doing and what the latest is with them. And it does seem at this point rather likely that we will maybe not see any Sears stores for much longer in Chicagoland.
They're certainly teetering on the brink. They're in bankruptcy, and Eddie Lampert, the chairman, former chairman, is trying to has one last shot at keeping Sears alive, perhaps as a retailer. Otherwise, it gets liquidated, and that's why my editors asked to sort of take a look at what happens if Sears does go away, because there's so many businesses and ventures they've touched over the years that people sometimes maybe forget some of the connections that Sears has to other concerns and buildings and brands and such that will likely live on if Sears doesn't. So that's kind of the tenor of the story that we took a look at.
That's right. And it's really such an interesting story that kind of speaks to the power of branding done well and really iconic branding, because, the Sears Tower is the biggest one of those where, we still call it that. I think even though it's been the Willis for quite a while, we still say, the Willis. But, similarly,
right.
I think so many people still say Comiskey. And then some people just started saying the sell in time for it to move to guaranteed rate. I think there's a powerful lesson in there about branding, I think, for a lot of brands.
Absolutely. It's a business sponsorship naming rights kind of thing that, a company sells the rights to an iconic structure and people don't always take to it. As you said, Comiskey, I still think of it as Comiskey. And yeah, guaranteed rate doesn't roll off the tongue, but that's what it is, and it's hard to make that change. I think Sears is probably because it's such a visible and important structure, at least in terms of the Chicago landscape, that I think there's probably a lot of people that never switched to Willis. It's been 10 years, believe it or not, that it's been Willis Tower.
Isn't that funny? It feels like it was like a year ago. It was a decade.
Yeah,
it just happened. That's funny. And
for sure.
And so, other brands, I think when we think of Sears, when we we immediately go to like Craftsman and Tools and that kind of thing. Long are the days with the Sears catalog. I think that's not a thing we think of as much anymore. Certainly, I think Tools and Craftsman and that kind of thing. What about those kind of offshoot brands that are under the Sears umbrella?
Craftsman really was sort of the highest value brand in a lot of ways. I mean, people attributed a quality to Craftsman tools. Some of the Sears brands, I was laughing. I digress, of course, but you think of something like Tough Skin jeans weren't a mark of excellence necessarily. I'm not saying they're bad pants, but
right.
you didn't score a lot of points wearing a pair of Tough Skins. I don't know what happens to things like that, but you do have some really brands like Kenmore, et cetera, that are associated with on their own with a kind of an image of quality or performance. Craftsman was at the top of that list, and they actually sold Craftsman already. So that's one that lives on no matter what. They in 2017, Stanley Black & Decker bought Craftsman from Sears for $900 million. So they're making their own line of Craftsman tools already. Sears had a sort of a license for, I think, 15 years to keep making Craftsman tools, but the brand is already owned by Stanley, and so it lives on regardless of what happens to Sears. And interestingly, I've looked back at the history. Craftsman was a name of a competing tool company back in 1927. Sears bought it for $500, reportedly. So wow. they bought the brand for $500 and just a short 90 years later sold it for $900 million. So that worked out pretty well.
I was going to say that's a pretty good business move right there, for sure.
For sure.
And then what about things like, you know, I think of the Sears Center in Hoffman Estates. That naming right goes through 2022. So what is that, if that's the case in which there's a, you know, the judge orders liquidation for Sears and that brand goes away, how does that kind of thing play out?
Well, it's unclear totally that, you know, they pay in advance. So if Sears went away tomorrow, which I don't think is necessarily the case, but the naming rights, I think they've already paid the bill for a while. So I think I can't, you know, maybe something happens in bankruptcy court or where they figure out some way to dispose of that. But it could be Sears Center after Sears was no more. I mean, I think they're good, as you said, I think through 2022. It's not clear what would happen to the name, but they already bought it. They bought those rights. And it's funny, I was thinking back that Sears actually, you know, was a developer of that. It's on their property in Hoffman Estates. They donated land for the construction of it with a real estate partner who's no longer involved in it. And, you know, so they're, it's more than just the name. They actually built it on their land. They paid money right away for the naming rights back in 06. And so they really, you know, have a stake in that property, whether the name goes on or not. But they have the name at least until 2022, it looks like, at this point.
That is really interesting. So you mentioned a bit earlier, I want to back up to this. You said there was kind of this one shot left to maybe salvage the Sears brand. And what exactly is that shot, and when do we expect to see that?
I'm not as up on that. They made me look at the history side of things. Lauren Zumbach has been following it, but Eddie Lampert has, at this point, he made I believe it's about a $5 billion offer for Sears, which the bankruptcy court will have to decide whether or not that's the best way to handle the future of Sears. It could be simply to break it up for parts, you know, and liquidate it, and somebody might buy Kenmore and somebody might buy, you know, other assets. So we don't know. I think we're going to know for sure by somewhere close to the end of the month what the bankruptcy court decides. But Eddie Lampert, who, you know, was the chairman and the driving force behind Sears in the most recent years, he has a shot at salvaging Sears as a retailer, saving some of the jobs. That's his bid. But he's been in charge for a few years and things have gone south. So it's not clear how it'll all play out. But somewhere in the next couple of weeks, we'll have an idea whether or not Sears as an entity continues.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. Well, we'll have to have you back on then and talk all about it.
There you go.
Thanks so much, Robert.
Sounds great.
Business reporter at Chicago Tribune. We'll talk to you then.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a surprising partnership with Coca-Cola and the Chinese government. More on that in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today in this very snowy, wintry day. It's distracting, I gotta say, sitting up here on the 18th floor of the Allstate Skyline Studio, watching all the snow swirling around. It's really quite beautiful up here, but lots to do on the show today. We're joined now by Andrew Jacobs, health and science reporter at New York Times, who wrote about the ways that Coca-Cola has buddied up with the government in China, even going so far as to open an office in the government's health ministry, which is not really how you would think that story would go. Andrew, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so talk us through this, because we don't often think about health ministries and Coca-Cola together, but nonetheless, that's where we are.
Well, this arrangement actually goes back to the 90s when China was first opening up to the West, and Coke got in there pretty early on and sought to partner up with the Chinese government in a way, you know, to essentially to help them develop nutrition and health guidelines. And back then, China didn't have a lot of resources, and so the idea seemed pretty good. Now, I should add that it wasn't Coca-Cola per se. It was an organization that they helped create called the International Life Sciences Institute, which is ostensibly sort of an independent institute that helps on health and nutrition matters, but it's basically funded by Coke, Pepsi, Yum Brands, all the big sort of multinational junk food companies, or I should say food companies, and a lot of them produce junk food. So that's how it sort of started out. Their offices are located within China's health ministry, and for the last few decades, they've been helping China write guidelines on nutrition and especially obesity, and helping them deal with their growing obesity crisis. Except the message they've been putting out on that is not sort of doesn't jive with what a lot of nutrition experts say it should be. So,
right.
Quite contentious.
And then fast forward to findings that were just recently published in a study that really kind of takes a look at this and this grouping of these junk food brands that are quite contrary to the healthful message the Chinese government is often kind of pushing with this fitness is best message.
Yeah, so the basically all the public health campaigns you see in China in the last decade or so are all about exercise. There's very little mention of watching calories, reducing your intake of sugary beverages and junk food. And that sort of runs contrary to what most experts say you need to do. If you want to lose weight, it's not just about exercise. Obviously, exercise is great, but you've got to also reduce what you're eating, especially when it comes to unhealthy foods. And so they have really helped craft this message. I should say Coca-Cola and these companies have helped craft that message. So right now in China, there's very little talk about junk food being bad for you. It's all the emphasis is on exercise.
Right. I mean, you can exercise all day long, but if you're eating a Big Mac every day, you know, you might run counter to your efforts a little bit. Interestingly, as you note in this story, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm gonna tweet this out after, because it's a really fascinating story that these brands, in particular Coca-Cola, tried a similar tactic here in the U.S., partnering with influential scientists and kind of working under nonprofit auspices and things like that to kind of go a similar route, to kind of perhaps get around the idea that the reputation that Coca-Cola has is certainly not being a healthful beverage.
Right. So they created something called the Global Energy Balance Network, which was an organization that partnered up with influential scientists, and what they would do is produce research that sent out that same message, which is exercise is best, and that's the way to approach the obesity crisis. And that effort was sort of, the New York Times wrote an article about that in 2015, and there was quite an uproar in the nutrition sort of community, and they very quickly disbanded that effort. But that is alive and well. That sort of philosophy is alive and well, not only in China, but in a lot of other developing countries where this organization, ILSI, has offices. They have 17 branches around the world, most of them in developing countries, and they sort of leverage their money and position to influence local health ministries in different countries and try to sort of influence them into taking that stance on obesity, which is growing all around the world, and especially in poorer countries that not long ago had a problem with food shortages, and now they have a problem of an abundance of processed food on their shelves, and a lot of people in these countries are getting unhealthy, very fat. So, you know, it's a very contentious issue.
Right. As you note in the story, just a couple of decades ago, there were food shortages in China. And now the number in the story that you put is 42% of adults in China are either overweight or obese, according to Chinese research.
Yeah. And a fifth of all children. Yeah, it's a pretty serious problem. And they're only just starting to grapple with this problem. And it seems, you know, for the moment, they're kind of not tackling in the way that is sort of experts believe you have to, which is you have to stress both messages, both exercise and, you know, watching what you eat. It's pretty critical.
Yeah.
To lose weight.
You know, and on the surface, this is just kind of a, wait, what? Kind of bizarre story. But really, when you dig into it and begin to unpack it a little bit, it's really about, it feels very much taking advantage of an economic situation and of people who, I mean, taking advantage of people, period, really, and putting their health, putting dollars above their health. And it is, as you're talking about going into developing markets and things like that with these brands that are fairly cheaply made foods and things like that. And so they're a little more accessible, that becomes quickly. I mean, it's not a huge leap to get to a big global problem pretty quickly there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these, you know, Coca-Cola and a lot of these companies have seen their profits declining in the U.S. in terms of soda sales. I should point out, you know, Americans and Europeans and a lot of other developed countries are starting to turn away from sugary beverages. So those profits are sinking. And so these companies are looking to the developing world to sort of beef up their bottom line. So it is, you could say, they're sort of putting profits ahead of public health, and that's, I think, the crux of the matter here.
Yeah. And so kind of what's next here? Are there groups trying to combat this? I know much of the reporting that you've done at New York Times has made quite a bit of impact here on this very topic, but are there, you know, advocacy groups that are trying to help people out here or shift the tide a little bit here?
There are, but it's, you know, at the moment, I don't know how much influence they have, but I think bringing attention to the problem is the first step. I think the responses that we got from Coca-Cola and ILSI, they seem to acknowledge that they had made some missteps and that they were sort of committed to changing the way they do things. So I think, you know, a lot of times just getting a little sunlight into these issues is the best disinfectant, and maybe this will you know, inspire them to do things differently. So I think for the moment, just sort of bringing attention to the problem is the, you know, the best that can be done.
Yeah, certainly. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about this story. Andrew Jacobs, health and science reporter at the New York Times.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So I think this is a really fascinating story. And again, for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share this on Twitter because I really want you to read it for yourself. Because as I said, it feels like one of those stories that you're just kind of a, what? That's ridiculous. Coca-Cola and all these other brands have, and Nestle and all that, they have an office in the health ministry. But when you really start digging into it, you're talking about taking advantage of people in a very unfortunate way that's playing with their health and large swaths of people's health. So very important to put light on those topics. So we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wind Trust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. You know, I like to give you a good long read once in a while because, you know, I tweet all these out after the show, and once in a while we will find the most fascinating in-depth story that I cannot resist but to share with you. And this is one of them. We are joined now by Alex Salmon, reporter at the New Republic, who wrote a really, really fascinating piece about Elwood, Illinois, which is a small town that is now a crucial shipping stop for companies like Amazon, Target, Walmart, all those guys, those big shipping companies, right? They do tons of e-commerce, a lot of shipping business. Okay, so Elwood, Illinois' development into a port for these companies has not quite been the boon for the town that was promised or expected. Alex, welcome to the program to talk about this story.
Thanks so much, Amy. I'm excited to be on.
All right. Well, I mean, this is a really, really fascinating story because it seems like it opens with so much promise. All this commerce and all these jobs are flowing into this community of 2,200 people. But the headline on the story is, in fact, Elwood, Illinois, population 2,200, has become a vital hub of America's consumer economy. And it's hell. All right. Talk us through from the beginning in which this wonderful, shiny promise of lots of jobs and stuff and activity is coming to Elwood, Illinois, to now.
Yeah, absolutely. So it starts off in the 70s. You have this this big, it's the Joliet Arsenal. It's a big munitions factory and building bombs for the Vietnam War and World War II. That closes down, so there's a decision that has to be made of what to do with it. And Elwood, Illinois, like a lot of the Midwest, you know, had farm failures of the 80s, the deindustrialization. They needed an infusion of jobs, and they decided that they were going to make an intermodal facility, basically an inland port, like you said. And And so they got a developer, and they offered some pretty generous tax breaks and set it up, and quickly the growth was massive, and the externalities were also pretty massive, and the landscape changed drastically, and the quality of life changed, and I think a lot of people would say it changed for the worse.
And how so? What has changed about the quality of life there?
Yeah, it's a number of things. The thing that came up most commonly in talking to people there was that actually the traffic was most horrifying in a lot of ways, just because you have tens of thousands of semi trucks hurtling down these local roads every day, and for people who are farmers and pedestrians and families and everything, that's resulted in a ton of traffic accidents, and oftentimes they're fatal. So it's brought, it's brought traffic fatalities, it's brought pollution, it's brought potholes, but it's also brought very low wage and precarious jobs and numerous other things, a lot of municipal debt as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what brought your attention to Elwood, Illinois, and its issues initially for this story?
Yeah, I think it's a very important town. I think, as we see something like the Amazon HQ2 horse race, all this energy being placed into trying to get, Amazon into your town. I thought it was interesting to kind of take a look at places where Amazon has already come to town and how that has changed life in these places, and as kind of our consumer economy becomes more and more reliant on e-commerce, what that means is, as big box stores are closing, the stuff isn't disappearing. It's going somewhere, and it happens to be going to Elwood, Illinois.
Yeah, and so what is the economic picture of Elwood, Illinois right now? Like, what did it look like before versus what is it like now?
Yeah, it's a very small town. Like you said, it's only 2,200 people, so a lot of corn, a lot of soybeans being farmed there, and understandably, they don't have a big municipal budget, but they are home to I think off the top of my head, the amount of goods that are passing through there is valued in the billions of dollars, and the town, because of the tax breaks they gave to this facility, is now $30 million in debt, which, doesn't seem like an outlandish number, but when you have only 2,200 people, it's a pretty towering figure.
Sure, certainly. And so we listed off a couple of the brands that are there, but who all is actually there at this point?
Yeah, it's kind of a who's who. There's if you can think of them, they're probably there. There's the Walmart. Walmart has I think its most important warehousing facilities in the country are there. There are five Amazon fulfillment centers across Will County. There are two huge Home Depots. There's a Mars, a refrigerated Mars facility where the candy goes through and the chocolate and all that. And then there's this giant IKEA facility, which I think is the second one, but that I think is maybe the largest one out there. It's very, very significant. But yeah, Target. The list goes on and on. It's everyone.
Well, and as I said, I'm going to share this story after the program, because there's so many issues that it comes to so quickly. But I think the labor piece of this is really interesting as we start looking at temp companies and the impact on workers and their livelihoods. It gets quite bleak very quickly.
Yeah, it absolutely does, and I think that I'd agree with you. I think that is kind of one of the most important pieces of the puzzle here, is that a ton of prosperity has come to this area. A ton of wealth is passing through, but the sort of jobs that are being created are incredibly precarious. They're temp jobs, as you mentioned. Very rarely do they ever cross over into being permanent full time jobs, and oftentimes it's because temp agencies are competing for contracts with other, for the warehouses, competing with other temp agencies. That pushes down on the labor force itself, and so you see workers getting nickel and dimed in every imaginable way, having to pay for their own drug tests, not being guaranteed hours, and it's a pretty bleak picture.
Yeah, it certainly sounds that way. And so was this situation immediately fraught? Like when these companies first started to come into town and do all of this and set all this up, was there a honeymoon period, or was it immediately kind of not without its issues?
It seemed like, you know, it's hindsight is 2020, and it's been almost a little over 15 years now. With the people that I spoke to seemed to be pretty unanimous in the fact that the problems came right away. They came fast and furious, and that it was quite evident that there were some serious issues, and they continued on. And, you know, as the growth exploded, I think that they just kind of lost the ability to regulate as these companies blossomed and these problems became more and more entrenched.
Sure, sure. I mean, I would imagine just off the top of my head, infrastructure would be very difficult to suddenly sustain a big, you know, influx like that. I'm interested. I see that our phone has been ringing a little bit. I wonder, we certainly do broadcast in Elwood, Illinois. So I wonder if we are hearing from any folks. I would love to hear from someone there for sure. 312-981-7200. But I wonder, what did you see anyway, residents doing? Is there any sort of grassroots action? I know that's a very David and Goliath thing to try to go up against these humongous corporations, but was there a sense of anyone trying to organize against this, or at least workers trying to organize themselves just for, you know, living wages and time off and things like that? That seems like there was with so many temp workers that a lot of the things that with steady employment was not there.
Yeah, there actually are. There were a number of groups that I spoke with, and there was a very impressive campaign that was organized by local residents called "Just Say No to North Point." So it was a group of residents and from all over, you know, all over the political spectrum and very different walks of life. Many of them not activists by trade, but who kind of got together and built a very impressive grassroots campaign to try to keep one of the bigger development plans from going forward. And they, in a very short time, built a pretty robust network and have made some serious inroads. Like you said, it's definitely a David and Goliath thing, but they've proven to be, at least in my opinion, very effective. And there's actually another group I should mention, too, called Warehouse Workers for Justice, which is a Chicagoland workers advocacy group. And they are involved in a lot of different parts of this and have been also very effective in winning real changes to the labor law and kind of getting some of those, I hesitate to even call them benefits, but some of those things that you would, you know, expect in full-time work and predictable hours and, you know, sick days and that sort of thing. So there are some groups and they are definitely making inroads.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you mentioned people that were not necessarily activists by trade, but I've often seen it to be the case that it's people that do huge things sometimes are people that don't necessarily come out of an activism space, but are just thrust into a situation where their kind of backs up is up against a wall and they kind of have no choice but to say, hey, wait a minute, something's got to be done here in my community. You know, we do have a caller, so I'm going to try to get you both on the air at the same time. Hope I can do this without messing it up. Here we go. Hi, Bob. Bob, you're calling from Joliet.
Right. Afternoon. How are you?
Bob, if you could turn your radio down.
Bob, if you could turn your radio
down. Hold on.
There we go.
How's that? Is that better?
That's perfect.
Sorry.
We're on a little bit of a delay, so we can. I don't need to hear my voice. I hear it all day. Anyway,
right.
You're calling us from Joliet about this story that we're talking about, and we have Alex Salmon on the air with us, too, from the reporter from the New Republic. What is your comment about this story?
Well, I was basically going to say, you know, Will County has been kind of the new home for these, you know, 1 million, 2 million square foot warehousing facilities. And, you know, they come in, first of all, under the tax law, they can accelerate the depreciation on these warehouses, but they can depreciate them within 10 years. Another part of it is they come in and they ask for 3-4 years tax abatement on the facility that they're building. I mean, I dealt with this in Minooka, which is, you know, right nearby, mm-hmm. on 4 1 million square foot warehouses. They asked for tax abatement, both from the school district and from the town. They wanted the town to spend $8 million on a water line to come across I-80 to service the warehouses. And, you know, they don't bring big-paying jobs. And then there's no longevity. And, yes, they hire a lot of temporary agency people because they don't want to pay benefits in that. And it's great to say Amazon's brought 5 warehouses to Will County. But if you look at the overall employment, what the county gets back from it is minimal.
Yeah.
And then of course they immediately, you know, if they're not putting the money into the school districts or the city or the infrastructure, but at the same time the community has to support with police and fire service and other municipal services, and at the same time the impact on the roads, you know, immediately around these facilities, because you're not bringing pickup trucks in. You're bringing big 53-foot, you know, containerized, you know, trailers in there.
Yeah, it sounds like you're echoing a lot of what it sounds like Alex found to be the case. Thanks so much for the call, Bob. I appreciate you. Yeah, Alex, so that sounds like we're hearing from Bob that exactly what you heard from a lot of residents there in Elwood, Illinois, about just the frustrations of lots of little things in a very death by a thousand cuts kind of way.
Yeah, it's definitely a common refrain. And I think that, you know, the frustration about, you know, the amount of public expenditure that goes into facilitating these, you know, massive, you know, privately held profits for these giant corporations, I think is totally understandable. That's kind of the same old story, is that, yeah, these municipalities they'll build out the water lines and they'll, you know, give them the tax abatements and you know, ton of wealth will pass through, but it doesn't tend to stay around or have a lasting positive impact on the community.
Yeah, well, really, really fascinating. Again, I'm going to share this story on Twitter for those of you who follow me, because I want you to read it for yourselves. The story is at the New Republic. Find it at newrepublic.com. Alex, I hope you will keep in touch with us and give us updates about this story. This is right here in our backyard, and we want to hear more about it as it continues to unfold. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, lots more to talk about, including a very interesting issue when it comes to intellectual property and dance. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. I'm really rock on any block. I'm really rock on any block. I mean, that's really more the sound we need here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm all about the hip hop. Hello, it's Amy Guth, 720 WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. And, you know, the reason we're playing that song is because, okay, do you know about this game Fortnite? It is sweeping the land, as one says. It is an extremely the most popular, I would say, video game.
I think undoubtedly. And it's weird that it is totally sweeping the nation, and yet you can also live here and not know anything,
about it. Right.
As I think both of us are kind of in that position.
But yet, this is a really fascinating story, because it has come to a head in that in the game there's dancing. However,
sort of,
right? However, it brings up some really fascinating issues about intellectual property and art. So if you know, we've talked on this show many times, right, about songs that are and copyright issues, like we talked about Vanilla Ice and David Bowie forever. I think we spent like 4 shows talking about that, you know, and Under Pressure, you know, all that.
Right, that was when that song Blurred Lines
That's
was
right.
in court.
It was when
Robin Thicke,
that was his name,
was in court with Marvin Gaye's estate.
That's right. So we were talking about that.
Right.
We were playing, I think, some of Ice Ice Baby and all that. So we talked about that. And it seems like a much easier case to make in cases of songs. But this game, because dancing appears in it, has brought up questions of intellectual property around choreography, which at first you're like, that seems kind of tricky. But when you put it in context of like a painting or any other kind of visual art or a song, it seems, okay, that's an art form too. It seems quite easy that could be your intellectual property.
Yeah, and it's a little confusing. So Fortnite is it's a survival game where you fight to stay alive and you're just roaming.
By dance off, not just like.
Well, you're roaming around this world and you find people and you're fighting to stay alive, basically. That is my understanding of it. And I think that is correct in a general sense.
Yeah, like that's good enough explanation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's free to download, but the way Fortnite makes money, and they believe me, they do make money.
A ton of money.
They make a ton of money. Because players purchase add-ons as they go along. So you're not just yourself running around. You have stuff that you can buy or things you can buy. And one of those things is you can buy choreography, basically. So your little avatar is running around fighting for survival, but maybe your little avatar wants to dance. And your avatar wants to do a...
My avatar always wants to dance.
Oh, well, that's beautiful. It wants to do a dance that is already permeated the culture. So.
Right. And it's not necessarily a dance step. It's not like doing the foxtrot. It's not like that. It's not like you're doing the Charleston. It's like doing the Carlton.
Right, the Carlton, yeah.
Yeah, which exactly is one of them in there. Yeah.
So the Carlton dance, if you remember from The Fresh Prince.
Who doesn't remember that?
I don't know. Maybe you're out there, you don't know. But Carlton did that dance usually to the song It's Not Unusual by Tom Jones.
Right. I can't hear that song without doing that dance.
Oh, it's so perfect. They're so perfectly suited. That is one of the dances, and Carlton would dance stereotypically as a white man might. I don't want to be
and too, you incited all the rage of listeners,
too provocative, but that was sort of the idea. So your little avatar can do the Carlton, or you can do the Millie Rock, which is the song that
that's
we played coming back, or the Backpack Kid. And I feel like he's the one that's getting the most press for suing Fortnite for using his dance. The Backpack Kid, or otherwise known as the Floss, which is everyone's doing all the time now, but you can do it in Fortnite. They're three of the people who are suing.
Well, the Backpack Kid is not. His mom is.
Oh, I'm sorry. I love that line in the story. That was the Backpack Kid's mom is suing.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to read that in the New York Times.
So it's Alfonso Ribeiro, who was the actor who played Carlton on the show Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Right.
To Millie, the song we played earlier, and the Backpack Kid's mother on his behalf are suing Epic Games for copyright infringement. They're also suing Take-Two Interactive Software, maker of the NBA 2K games, which also allows players to buy the dances. I think it's a really fascinating conversation about intellectual property and art.
Can you own dance?
A dance. I mean, I think in particular, I don't know, I wouldn't say the best case, but I would say the Carlton is an interesting one because ostensibly that is, I would say the actor has a right to that, but also the network.
I was going
to
say, yeah, he did it on a show. Maybe they would feel like they have grounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, but which was, I don't remember what channel. Was that NBC? I don't know. It was so long ago.
I want to say it was ABC. Yeah, I don't remember either. But I feel like, you know, there's so many iconic lines from sitcoms that come out and stick around a while.
Yep.
That that's definitely, I feel like that's definitely the intellectual property of the screenwriter, of the network. That gets complicated, really.
It's very complicated, very fast. But let's say it's a little less complicated maybe for Two Millie, who wrote this and created the dance, Millie Rock.
That's right.
And that's just totally his own. I mean, maybe the record label gets involved in that case. But so there's always like a question of ownership. But do you just baseline, without leaving aside all that, do you think that Two Millie deserves to win his case against Epic Games?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do too. Yeah. I think they all do for kind of different reasons.
It's so tough. I mean, yeah, these are, in each case, these are dances that are like so widely used in the culture that they feel like they belong to everybody now.
That's exactly where it's tricky. And that's why
that's what Fortnite thought that they could skate on.
Right. Because at first you're like, why would they think they could do that? But then you're like, no, when something is so big, it does feel like we all own a piece of it. It's all of ours. So that's a tricky one. It's really interesting. So anyway, I'm going to tweet this story out so we can all discuss it on the Twitters and all that good stuff. But we're going to get you to news, take a break first, then get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN.